That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said. Well, that's what she said.
Welcome to That's What She Said, conversations with interesting people from the world of sports, music, comedy, and more, talking about their lives, careers, successes, and failures. Welcome to the latest edition of That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. My old teammate Victoria Jackson was on a couple weeks ago, and she said, you've got to talk to Peter Sagal, host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, such an interesting guy. And boy, was she right. I absolutely love this conversation with him. I'm a big Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me listener, but there are so many other aspects of his life beyond that show that I had no idea about. It was so interesting to talk to him. And in researching for it, there were just all these thoughts and quotes from him about life that really spurred my interest in, and also things that just seemed like he got me. And one of those was, some people are just born to be alcoholics. They have that first drink and there you are. And that, of course, leads them to a dark place. Sometimes I feel that way about Twitter. And that hit me in all the spots, because Lord knows, sometimes I need to step away and get out of the dark place. But I love this conversation with Peter Sagal. He's been hosting Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me since 1998. So in that seat for quite some time, bringing people entertainment and such an interesting interview. So I hope you enjoy my conversation.
That's what she said.
Happy to welcome in this week's guest, Peter Sagal, screenwriter, playwright, voice actor, co-host of the WBEZ podcast, Nerdette recaps Game of Thrones with Peter Sagal, and of course, most notably, host of NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me since 1998. We're not going to go to 1998. We're going to go before that. That's where we're going to start. So what kind of kid were you? What were you into?
I was the nerdiest kid imaginable. And I just want to say that this was long before being a nerd was cool. And those of us who were nerds back in the 70s, we get a little, you know, a little upset when people say, yeah, I'm a nerd, I'm cool. Because, you know, being a nerd back then wasn't as easy. What I mean to say is that I was bookish and unathletic, and I was interested in all the things that nerds love today with proudly, things like Star Trek. I was a huge fan of Star Trek on TV and science fiction. I ended up with a library that must have been 1,000, you know, lurid science fiction paperbacks with, you know, interesting covers. I was a huge Lord of the Rings nerd long before that became a popular thing, or at least as popular as it is now. This is like one of statements of my nerd cred. I actually tried to teach my dog Elvish. So that's who I was. If you had met me at the time, you would have said, that kid's going to have a career in public radio.
Well, but you did start running with your dad, and briefly you were on the cross-country team. So you got into sports a little bit, which is very unnerdy of you, although I would say
it was.
As a track runner myself, cross-country is the most nerdy of sports.
Well, yes. I've actually subsequently learned that like the real jocks, I mean, I learned years ago, and I include this in my book, there's a saying in sports, those who can't play sports run, those who can't run, run long. And that's certainly my case. I was never enough of a serious athlete, jock, whatever you want to call it, to actually run track. I mean, jump a hurdle, sprint, are you kidding me? I wasn't even very good at cross country, because there's a certain gene that people have, men, women, that makes them, when somebody's about to beat them at a physical challenge, it makes them want to go faster and beat that person. Oh, no, you're not going to beat me too. I totally lacked that gene. So even in my year of cross country, I think the way I put it, I got beaten regularly like a lunch gong. I mean, so I did, and this is sort of the origin of both my life story and my book. I did decide to do something about that nerdiness, which, among other things, led to a lot of indolence. You know, we nerds were interested in things on screens in front of us. Back then, the only screen we had was a TV, but still. And books and all kinds of brainiac things, and basically, I was just using the rest of my body only to transport my head from like tables to desks to chairs. And I decided, looking in the mirror one day, I was overweight, I was pimpled, hadn't yet lost my hair, although that was to come. And I said, I got to do something about something. And I said, one thing I can do is try to get some exercise. And so my father, who was a you know, a member of that 70s running generation inspired by the Canadian Air Force exercise book and Jim Fix's complete book of running. I said to him, will you take me running? And he did. He didn't like make fun of me for finally, you know, wanting to come along. He woke me up at 6 a.m. the next day and took me for a run. It was the hardest damn thing I'd ever done. I made it half a mile. My lungs were exploding. But I got up the next day and I did it again, which I have to say, I still weirdly am kind of proud of that I did that because, you know, it's one thing to say you're going to do it.
Yeah.
It's another thing to do it again when the first time really hurt.
I want to get back to the running, but I quickly, you know, I was reading a Chicago Magazine interview with you, and your parents were incredibly supportive. You're so bright. You're going to do great things. And imposter syndrome is a recurring theme on this podcast. I bring it up a lot. And so sometimes super supportive parents can instill healthy confidence, the kind of ego that is always tempered by the things that you come across in life that bat you back down, but allows you to keep this like level base of, you know, I'm good enough, I'm smart enough. In your case, their extreme confidence in you instilled doubt. Why do you think that is?
Yeah. It's interesting you raise that. And it's a surprise to me that that's a theme of yours if you're dealing with successful athletes. But yeah, it's true. I remember toward the end of my college career, I was talking to a friend and more than anybody else I knew, he was just so calm and confident and at ease in the world in a way that I could only envy. And I said to him, what's your secret? Seriously, you know, where did you get this confidence? And he said, well, I was raised by very supportive parents who made me believe, who let me know that I could do anything I set out to do. And that's why I have this confidence. And it's funny because I probably said this aloud to him. I certainly thought it. That's funny. I was raised with parents who believe I could do anything I set out to do. So I better do something worthwhile, right? And you know, I want to be careful because, you know, I don't want to blame my parents for anything. As you said, they were extremely supportive to me in anything I wanted to do to this day. But, and they're still both happily with us. My father is quite healthy at 83, which I guess has something to do with his running career. You mentioned the imposter syndrome. And, you know, if you're constantly told that you are very bright and very capable and can do anything, then sometimes, and some of us, depending on, I don't know, our luck, our genes, our brain chemistry, we take that as a message that whatever we do will not quite be good enough. And
right.
It's funny, I'm a Harvard graduate, and I just had my 30th reunion. But at my 25th reunion, it was really interesting because these are Harvard graduates. These are supposedly the best and the brightest, right? And sure enough, every single person there had achieved wonderful things. There were doctors and PhDs. There were highly paid lawyers and political figures. I believe there were 3 members of President Obama's cabinet in my college class, okay? And yet everybody there, almost literally, felt inadequate, felt like they hadn't done enough, felt like, oh, yeah, sure, you know, I got a PhD in neurochemistry, but that guy runs a whole lab, and sure, you know, I'm a lawyer, and I, you know, but that guy, and it was amazing, and it was so ubiquitous. I had a chance to host the talent show for that reunion, and I said to everybody, you know, I've been having these conversations with everybody, so I think what we need to do is we need to line everybody up in order of envy. You know, Bob envies Jill, who envies Jennifer, who envies whatever.
Right.
And you get that lined up, and then you find the last person who everybody envies, and you kill them, and then we can all be happy.
Perfect. Exactly. Well, it's interesting because I think if imposter syndrome truly holds you back from doing things, it's a negative. But in a lot of ways, the successful people who feel it, that's just a smart awareness that you could be better and you could do more. And if that drives you, then it's not so bad. But I think it depends on the lens through which you see it. I would also recommend that maybe if all of you had gone to Cornell instead, you wouldn't feel so bad about yourselves.
I think you're right. And probably be wearing Cornell regalia and sweatshirts without feeling that people would think we are complete. I had a conversation with Sally Bergeson, who's a wonderful person and runs Wiesel, the women's running clothing company. And she grew up with a lot of imposed, let's say, lack of confidence about herself and specifically her body. She was body shamed by, you know, intimate people. She grew up with a lot of not a lot of confidence about herself. And that drove her really to become a runner and an athlete, a significant one, really. She's quite good. And so, yeah, you're right. Sometimes that insecurity and that, you know, that perennial dissatisfaction can lead to great things.
Yeah. So back to the running. So what's interesting is you start running with your dad, you do cross country for a short amount of time, and then you stop running seriously until 40. And, you know, obviously my old teammate from high school, Victoria Jackson, was just on the pod and said she runs with you when she's in town, and that now you're into it all the time.
14 marathons, Dan.
14 marathons. Anyway, and is your PR still 3:09?
Yes. I haven't beaten that and probably won't.
Not with that attitude. But you
not at
beyond,
this age.
Right. Not beyond all the marathons. Your last two, I believe, Boston marathons, you ran as a guide for legally blind runners, which is an incredible achievement and a totally new way to approach a marathon. You wrote about it for Runner's World because in one of those experiences, it happened to be during the Boston Marathon bombing. And this line just stood out to me. You wrote, our team leader, this was, you had crossed the finish line and just minutes after you had crossed was when the first bomb hit and you guys didn't really know what was going on. Everyone was trying to figure out what had happened. Our team leader was hearing bad news that it was a bomb, that there were injuries, that the race had been halted, leaving his runners, half of whom were blind, out on the course with nowhere to go. I can't imagine the fear of everybody there, but then adding on to that, the fear of being with somebody who is incapable of seeing what's going on and potentially helping themselves get out of danger. So, I mean, tell me about that experience, because for you, you sort of downplay it because you say you were past the finish line when it happened. You had done the marathon and then the bombing happened, but you obviously were still there for all of the aftermath.
Yeah, it's true. That actually, that really was the first time I had run as a guide for a blind runner. I've done it four times now, three times.
Oh, wow.
And it's true. We had crossed the finish line. And obviously, if you've ever been to a marathon, you know, especially at a big major marathon like Boston, the finish line itself is a big physical structure, right? It's, you know, it's like an arch over it, and it's got lights, and it's got cameras, and it's got all kinds of things, PA announcers, right? It's a big thing. We were 100 yards beyond it. My partner that day, a runner named William Greer, he was exhausted. He ran a brave and tough marathon and was not feeling his best. And he was sort of doubled over and trying to catch his breath. We didn't move very much. And so we were only 100 yards over the finish line, beyond it, 4 minutes later after we crossed when the bombs went off. So we heard it. It was the loudest noise I've ever heard to this day, and then heard the second one slightly further away. And we had no idea what had happened. Because of the superstructure, we couldn't see the bomb site. If we could, we would have seen what the images that came out that day showed: people in extraordinary pain, terribly injured people, blood, smoke, confusion. We didn't see any of that. All we knew is that something really weird had happened. And what's weird is because we didn't have our phones, we had just run a marathon, we were not among the millions, I guess, the general population who were getting alerts, tweets, oh, there's a bombing at the Boston Marathon, there's reports of explosions. We didn't know anything. I remember talking to a woman who was standing next to me. I said, what do you think that was? Could it have been a car backfire? No, it was too loud. So while the nation, and people probably remember that day, while the nation was sort of reacting in shock to what had just happened, we remained the last innocent people because we couldn't see it. We didn't have our phones. We had no way of getting any information. And the officials in the chute, in the finishing chute, who were getting information through their radio headsets, weren't sharing it. They just looked really alarmed and worried and scared and kept telling us, keep moving, everybody, move away, move away, move this way. So it wasn't until, it's not false modesty. We didn't know what had happened. We didn't know that we should be scared or concerned or anything. It was only much later, hours later, that I realized that my partner, William Greer, the guy I was guiding, like I said, he was having a terrible marathon. He was stopping to use porta potties. He was stopping to walk and stretch his legs out. He had told me that he was feeling so badly, he didn't think he could walk. He didn't think, rather, he could run the last mile. And if you know Boston, the last mile is amazing. You know, right on Hereford, left on Boston, there's a big, all of a sudden, a canyon, skyscrapers, people cheering. He had to walk it. But he just pulled it out of somewhere, this guts and glory, that he decided to run that last mile. And if he had needed to walk it like he thought he did, I can't say for certain, but who knows where we'd be. We crossed the line 4 minutes before the bombs went off.
Right.
If you're walking a mile rather than running it, is that a difference of 4 minutes? I don't know. But it was really like a remarkable moment to realize how much just bizarre fortune played in our, you know, walking away from Boston totally unharmed.
So running has become a big part of your life post 40 as you rediscovered it. And you have a book coming out in October called The Incomplete Book of Running. What do you have to say about running and what's in the book? And obviously it's incomplete because there's so much to say.
Well,
but
the title, as I hope people certainly of my generation will know, is a tribute to Jim Fix's Complete Book of Running. This is the book, massive national bestseller when it came out around 1980. Sold millions and millions and millions of copies, so much so that Fix had to write a second complete book of running. And it fueled the huge running boom that happened at that time. Among many other things, the movie Forrest Gump refers to when he starts running. It's part of that historical moment in America where everybody was running and talking about running, and the shoe companies exploded, and Nike exploded, and Puma and all this stuff. And so this tribute to him, it was a very influential book on my father and his running career and myself when I started. But in terms of my book, one of the reasons it's called The Incomplete Book of Running is because I do not pretend that this is a guide. Like, oh, you want to run a marathon? Read my book and you'll figure out how to do it. there are plenty of other books about that. It's really more about what running has done to my life and what I've learned via running. It's a lot of stories of people I've met and experiences I've had because of running, the Boston Marathon. Obviously, I write about that. Guiding Blind Runners, I write about that. But also just the people I've met and the weird places I found myself running, you know, in red underwear with a heart shaved into my chest for a charity run in St. Louis and getting lost in various national parks and bizarre suburbs. And also, you know, I think it's also, remember I said that when I was a kid, I spent all of my time essentially in my head. I was reading things, I was watching things, I was sometimes writing things, I was worrying about things. And it's also a book about what, I guess, athleticism or physical activity means to people like me. This book is not written for people like you who are track runners who know a lot about, you know, performance and training. This is a book for people like me who need to get outside and need to use their bodies for something else. And hopefully, I'm hoping that even though it's not a, you know, run this many miles on Monday and this many miles on Tuesday kind of book, it might inspire people who are currently indolent to pick up, if not running, something like it.
Yeah. Very cool. Good luck with that. That's exciting for you. Not your first book, of course. You've done a lot of writing.
No.
You were an English lit major at Harvard. You moved eventually at some point out to L.A. to write plays and act. And I read that you were an extra in a Michael Jackson video. I must hear.
Yes. For a long time, I thought that would lead my obit. I was living in L.A. I was an aspiring person. You know, I'm an aspiring writer, actor, whatever. And as an aspiring whatever, I got a call one day. would you like to be an extra in the new Michael Jackson video? Well, of course you say yes, right? You don't say no. At the very least, I kind of knew that 30 years later I'd be talking about it.
Right.
So, you know, I have a good friend who said to me many years ago, you should view any potential experience in the light of its future anecdotal value. And by that rule, this was an absolute no-brainer. So the video, everybody, when you say, by the way, that you were an extra in a Michael Jackson music video, everybody assumes you were a zombie in Thriller. I was not a zombie in Thriller. First of all, those were not extras. Those were trained and excellent dancers. I was an extra cast in the less famous video for Remember the Time. Are you a Jackson head? You know this one? Remember the Time.
Of course, I know the song. I mean, that was the one with, wasn't Eddie Murphy in that video?
Yes,
it was the big Egyptian scene.
And Yes, you got it. John Singleton, who was at that time a very big director in Hollywood. He had just made Boys in the Hood, and he was directing it, and it was this big ancient Egypt theme that Michael Jackson travels back in time, and Eddie Murphy, huge movie star, he's the pharaoh, and Imam, beautiful model, she's the pharaoh's wife, and there are other, and Magic Johnson is in it, all these other people. And there's a scene in which they're chasing Michael Jackson for reasons that are not clear, and he runs through a marketplace, and that was the scene with the extras, and I was cast as the snake charmer. They said, you're going to be the snake charmer. Great. So show up here.
So typical Hollywood, a white man playing what was presumably.
Well, you know, it is a little strange. There might have been something going on by, like, the peasants were all played by white people and the royalty were all played by black people. Who knows?
Okay. All right. So, okay. We'll give them that. That's a John Singleton. That's John Singleton movie.
Look, you know, what can I tell you? A job's a job. I'm not going to say no. But here's the thing, because I'm sure everybody is turning off this podcast and immediately calling up this video to see if they can find me. They didn't end up shooting the scene with the snake charm. So I am actually not in the video. However, I did meet Michael Jackson because.
So there's that.
One of the most amazing things I've ever seen was, we're on this big sound stage. I've got this marketplace set up and they've rehearsed it. There's a guy who looks just like Michael Jackson. It's his dance double and he can dance just like Michael Jackson. And so they've rehearsed, you know, the whole thing. They know where the camera's going to go. And then it was time, and the doors opened, and in comes, it's like a royal procession. It was literally like a pharaoh entering the room, except it was Michael Jackson, and he was attended by his security guards, and his entourage, and his videographer, who I was told videoed everything he did. So that was his entrance before they shot the scene. And then they shot the scene, and Michael Jackson sang and danced, and it was very impressive. And then he decided, I guess, that he would, you know, like Henry V, he would go among the people.
Meet his subjects, so yes.
Yes, he would meet his subjects. So I'm standing there talking to these people, and all of a sudden they stare over my shoulder at something behind me, and I turn around and it's Michael Jackson, who's 3 feet from me. And I reach out my hand and I say, nice to meet you. And he shakes my hand and he says, nice to meet you too. So there you
That's
go.
That's great. I met Michael Jackson at a movie theater in L.A. when I lived in L.A. So we have that in
common.
What
was that like?
And I was also cut out of one of my first parts in L.A. and didn't make it after I told everyone to watch on TV. So I've got that as well.
Oh,
he was with his kids.
That's a pretty – Yeah. That's a fairly – do you know the famous story about Kevin Costner?
No.
That Kevin Costner was – his first big role was he was the guy who killed himself in the movie The Big Chill. Remember that movie?
Yeah.
They all gather for a funeral of a friend who's killed. He was the guy who killed
himself.
The
beginning.
But the only shot of him that ended up in the movie is the shot of his wrist when they're dressing his body. That's it. And so because of that, Lawrence Kasdan promised him, well, I'll put you in my next movie. And he was in Silverado and his career started. Anyway,
that's funny.
But what was your visit with Michael Jackson like? Did you talk to him?
I worked in a restaurant in the Century City Mall, and he had gone to see Finding Nemo with his kids, and the kids had the masks on. This was when he would have them walking around with masks on their face. And he was waiting to get picked up at the valet, and it was very late, so I think he presumed most people wouldn't be around, and I was coming out of my shift at work, so I'd had to do all the stuff after the restaurant closed. And I just said, oh my gosh, you guys are up late. And he said, oh, you know, we were at the movie and whatever. So we had a quick chat about how it was Finding Nemo and everything else, and that was about it. But he was very nice in that brief encounter.
He seemed very nice.
Yes.
So that we can both say that. Although I think you can attempt to imitate his voice. I do not dare. So
probably best if neither of us do. Or his dance moves. So you were recently doing a live edition of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. It's 20 years now for the show in Millennium Park here in Chicago.
Yes.
And there was an interesting article in the Chicago Tribune in which you talked about the balance between making fun of current politics and giving people a break from them, because ultimately your show is not intended as much to inform as it is to entertain. We don't really do politics around these parts at ESPN, but I wonder how it works behind the scenes amongst everyone on that show, deciding how much of what's going on in our current politics to do and when you feel like you need a break.
That is the discussion. I won't say argument, but it's certainly a creative discussion that we have every single week. And that is a sign of the times. In the before times, back when things were different, our conversation around in the office was like, well, what's interesting enough to bring to the audience this week? Gosh, how are we going to start the show? What can we make funny? You know, we'd look through, you know, oh my God, they signed a treaty. Is anything funny about the treaty? Quick, somebody be funny about a treaty. We were a little desperate. You know what it's like to try to fill time. Since things changed and Donald Trump entered the arena, now it's, you know, the public arena. It's now a much different problem because there's too much stuff.
Yeah.
You know, every week on Tuesday of any given week, you'd be like, oh my God, we're going to have to talk about this astounding, amazing, unprecedented, crazy thing that just happened. And then something happens Wednesday. That's even crazier. And so these days we're doing a kind of weird sort of insanity triage. We're like, of all the insane, crazy things to talk about, what are the one or maybe two we're going to talk about? And what we're trying to do, and I meant what I said to the Tribune, and I've been saying it to other people for many, many years. I gave up long ago the notion that doing a comedy show about the news, I was speaking truth to power because power doesn't listen. Mm-hmm. And we should never think of ourselves as people who are trying to make a difference in the world, among other things. I think the people who actually do make a difference in the world are not funny, and our job is to be funny. And what I see our role in this great cacophony, the little small part we play, wait, is to give people a break, to be entertaining, to be fun, especially in public radio. People tend to be very serious and they expect things to be very serious. They really want it to be serious because it's serious times and serious issues. And we give them an hour away from that.
Yeah.
Part of what we do is we say the things about the news, as I like to say. We say the things on the radio that most people end up shouting at the radio. So we give voice to people's frustration, their amusement, their bemusement, their incredulity. We say these crazy, mean things about people who are more powerful than we are, and that people enjoy that. And then we move on. And we talk about animals smuggled down pants or people being dumb in far corners of the world, or weird stories in the world of sports, or weird stories in the world of art. And that, I think, is just as, if not more important than the political stuff we do in the show, because people need something else to think about, you know?
I think you're right that people who really make a difference usually aren't funny, and that people who are funny usually aren't making that much of a difference. But there was a really good Malcolm Gladwell podcast on satire.
I think about that all the time.
Essentially, that was saying it's toothless, right?
I didn't like his criticism of satire in the United States because he thought it didn't do any good and didn't change anybody's mind. Because, as I said, I don't think that's my role or Stephen Colbert's role, who he particularly criticized. But he did say this interesting thing, or he quoted somebody. He said that, you know, there's an expression along the lines, well, you know, all you can do is laugh.
Yeah.
And in that statement, which everybody would agree with sometimes, hey, you know, all you can do is laugh as a coping mechanism, as a way of dealing with whatever just happened. There's a surrender there, right? Oh, we're just going to laugh about it. And that's why I think what I said earlier is true, that those of us whose job it is to make fun of stuff and make jokes about it, we might provide a service in terms of people's mental health. And I hope we
do. For sure.
But we're not going to change anything that actually needs changing. And if you think about the people who actually make changes, be they politicians, on the day we're talking, there's this amazing video going around of Beto O'Rourke in Texas answering a question. You may have seen it, answering a question about what he thinks of the NFL protesters kneeling during the anthem. And he gives a really wonderful, detailed, substantive answer of why he supports them. And it's powerful and it's moving. It's reminiscent to some people of RFK. He makes some great points. I'll tell you one thing. It's not funny.
Yeah,
make a joke about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I guess for the most part, I agree with you and Gladwell that comedy is essentially inadequate if you're trying to actually make meaningful, significant change. But I suppose I disagree in that, much like sports, there are things that people aren't interested in engaging in or learning about or evolving on unless you present it to them in a way that's palatable. And so in sports, you begin to discuss things like race or LGBTQ issues or the national anthem and police brutality, and they're forced onto people who otherwise would ignore them. And they have to listen to someone that they otherwise admire talk about it. And maybe they hate them and it changes their opinion of that person and they no longer admire them. Or maybe because of that admiration, they listen a little bit more. And I feel that way with comedy, that sometimes if you're someone who's not really interested in politics, but you want to watch Colbert or John Oliver or Pod Save America or Bill Maher or something else, you learn more and your opinion on things changes because of the way it's presented, which you might not otherwise feel if you were reading a straight news item.
I think, first of all, everything you just said is true. And it's certainly not only has everything you say true, but it's been the guiding philosophy, not just behind, you know, comedy and to a certain extent sports, but behind the news itself. If there's one thing that's driven the development of news, and I mean this of everybody from Access Hollywood to NPR, it's people trying to make the news more entertaining, not necessarily salacious or musical, but just something that an audience would like as they learn stuff. I mean, if you go back and you listen or you look at news from 20 or 30 years ago, when I was growing up, 40 years ago, it's not at all. It's so dry. It's so, you know, it's serious white men reading off pieces of paper into cameras and that's it. And there's been a huge struggle to make news interesting, and to and one of the things that I think that is so very important about sports is it's not so much that people are watching sports and getting a political or a civic message. It's that people they admire via sports, because of sports, will take that podium sometimes and make a statement. And we're seeing that in the NFL, and we've seen that obviously in the NBA, and I think that's great. Because if, you know, if we need LeBron James, the greatest basketball player of all time, to say something that people will listen and hear it, that's awesome. And I think it's important, and you're right. But I still hold that everything you're saying being true, if your goal is to be funny, as mine is on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, then you're going to get in the way of real change. And it's interesting. Of the people you mentioned, the one person who's really trying to make change through comedy is John Oliver. And I'm really interested in him and his show. I have a friend who writes for it. But what's really interesting is he gets on his big topics. He says, I'm gonna teach you today about political donations or about the justice system or sentencing reform or something really serious and dry. And he presents it to you as funny as possible. But he very rarely jokes about the topic itself. What he does is he'll start, we're going to talk about sentencing reform. So you may know that most people don't actually go to trial. And then he'll make a joke about something else entirely, right? And then he'll go back and say, okay, at trial instead, people will make deals with prosecutors so they don't have good representation. And then he'll make a joke about something else entirely. And when I watch his monologues, or his, I should say like in-depth reports, it's almost as if he's giving you a little treat to keep you paying attention. Like when I'm trying to train my dog to do something, to pay attention. Here, if you just hang here for another 30 seconds, I'll give you a little treat. So I would argue even John Oliver, who out of all the people is trying to actually affect people's opinions and share information they may not have through comedy, even he knows and operates on the principle that ultimately these issues are not funny.
Right. Yeah, and that's a great point. And he does do that very differently on his big topic of the day, and with intention, as you said.
Hey, everybody, don't forget to go to ESPN and Apple Podcasts and subscribe to That's What She Said with Sarah Spain so you always have the latest episode. Don't forget to rate and review it as well and tell all your friends how awesome it is.
You know, you mentioned Malcolm Gladwell saying, you know, all you can do is laugh, and it's a coping mechanism, and so is some of these shows and the way we approach some of the news of the day. By getting it with that dose of sugar, it allows us to both learn and also work our way through it without combusting. And I heard your interview on the hilarious World of Depression, and the conversation of it's not funny, but we cope with it by being funny. That's how you deal with both depression and death. And you had a line that you said, I found that being forced to be funny made me feel better. That was also in the Chicago Tribune article. And you talked about the doctor that you work with. And another random common topic that I'm fascinated by is neuroplasticity and the idea that our brains are not one way. You can change them and create synapses and make it easier for you to access moments of gratitude or happiness. Or in the case of depression, you can make it easier to continue to be sad by working those synapses all day. And so these coping mechanisms that might seem like a distraction end up actually working you out of those moments of despair.
Yeah.
When did you kind of decide that you were interested in the brain chemistry side of what you ultimately came to find was a depression you had mostly dealt with until significant life changes that sort of brought your life to a halt?
Well, believe me, it wasn't a choice I made willingly. It was a choice that was forced upon me. As you said, you know, I feel, and I should say that I know now, that I've always been a depressive. And that probably has something to do with something we were talking about earlier, why I took my parents' faith in me as a challenge that I would never meet,
right,
rather than, as my friend did, a source of confidence that he could do whatever he wanted. I mean, one reaction to that, one reaction is healthy and one is depressive. But I always coped with it really well. And then something really, really terrible happened. A divorce, which I had hoped and thought really could be amicable, and the other person involved decided it wouldn't be. And really, really terrible things began to happen, stuff that I don't think I can talk about because it's just an issue of my family's privacy. But suffice to say that you may have nightmares sometimes. I did, and I would wake up having had a nightmare about my family, and the nightmare was true, right? Waking up, it didn't end the scenario. And so if somebody like me, who tends to take very small setbacks way too seriously and get really upset about like the smallest little, you know, traffic ticket or lack of applause for a joke or anything minor like that, when something major happens, I'll be blunt, your life is in danger.
Right.
And I needed to cope with it. And I cope with it in two primary ways. One of them was medication. I probably thought when, you know, Prozac and antidepressants came along that those are for weak people and people who couldn't handle their own problems and people who needed to be drugged. I've completely changed my mind about that now. I think in my case, they were life-saving. And the other thing I had to do was deal with my life. I mean, there's a tendency, especially for depressive people and especially for people going through trauma, to withdraw, right? To just back away from the world that's causing you so much pain. But as many people know who've been through this, that's exactly the wrong thing to do because the isolation magnifies the depression and the trauma. Not only are you going through whatever you're going through, be it illness or crisis or whatever, now you're doing it alone. In my case, obviously, my family wasn't a place I could go, which was part of the problem, but my colleagues were, my friends were, and most of all, I had this job. And I knew that literally millions of people looked forward to me doing that job, and they were depending on me, if only for an hour of entertainment. And that further, in order to do that job well, I had to be funny.
Right.
And I can't be funny when I'm sad, because people can tell. So I just had to put on a happy face. I had to fake it till I made it, as it were. And as my friend Dan Levitin, a well-known neuroscientist, said on that podcast, it turns out that that kind of coping, distraction from your troubles, social interaction with people who are not involved in your troubles, that is an actually very effective way of dealing with real trauma. So I can't say if I didn't have this good fortune to have this job, if I would have stumbled upon that strategy, but I was forced into it and it worked very well.
In that Chicago Tribune story, you said, I ended up a theater kid because it's a way to be in front of people with instructions. And you talked in the podcast about being sort of socially awkward and you envied people who were effortlessly social. I'm effortlessly social. I'm so, so, so extroverted. And so for me, it feels very natural to be on television and on the radio and interacting with people all the time. I'm sort of fascinated by people who make a living doing something that feels to me social. But I guess the construct of acting or being on the radio appeals because it's a construct. It's like you said, you have instructions.
It's
Why does it make it better?
It's a Yeah, it is. And for some, and for people like myself, I mean, there are lots of stories of people who are brilliant actors who, when you get them off stage, can hardly speak.
Right.
And hardly have a personality. And that's also true of all kinds of performers. Some of the dullest people I've ever interviewed on my show are brilliant comedians. Because
yes.
when they're off stage, either they don't want to or they just can't be that bright and witty and charming. And so, yeah, first of all, I envy you. I wish I had that. But one of the things that I've learned to do over the years is two things. First of all, I learned very early on. I've had one job in radio, so I had to learn this as I did it. wait, don't tell me. And one of the things I learned is when I was in the theater, my job was to be creative, witty, funny, subversive. I needed to surprise people with stuff they hadn't seen before, to challenge them, maybe even to anger them a little, right? But in radio, none of that helps. What people listen to the radio for, or podcasts, I guess, is because they want to spend time with the person they're hearing. They need to like that person. And the person who taught me this was my executive producer, Doug Berman, who prior to my show was also the producer of Car Talk, which starred two of the most delightful people in public radio, not in all of media, the Tom and Ray, the Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers. And so I learned over the years that I had to sort of present myself to the world in a very positive way. I had to be charming. I had to be friendly. I had to be kind. I had to be interested. And those are all good things to be. So it's another instance of sort of faking it until I made it. I realized that I didn't have to stop being that person when the microphone was off. I could continue to be a good and interesting and charming and kind and social person, even off the mic. And that's been sort of a revelation to me. And I think, I hope, a positive.
Yeah. I've a speed round for you because we're running out of time here. And I know you said Parks and Rec was one of your best coping mechanisms.
Oh, yes. I love that show. I've worked my way almost through the entire principal cast. I got like three left to go, so I can thank them all in person.
Have you met and had Mike Schur on your show? Because he's fascinating. I just had him on the podcast. He created that show. And I feel like you guys would have an incredible dialogue.
Oh, Mike Schur followed me about six, maybe more years than that at Harvard. And I followed his career. His partner when they worked in The Office, Greg Daniels, is somebody I did know at school.
Yeah.
And I think Mike Schur is a genius. I love Parks and Rec. I love his new show. The Good Place, it's brilliant. And I've reached out to him through Twitter and never got anything back, but I've absolutely heard that he's a wonderful and interesting and insightful person, in addition to being a great maker of fun television shows.
Well, I have his email, so I'll tell him to hit you up. I would like to see him on
Please.
Wait, Don't Tell Me. I think that would be great.
I think that would be awesome, too. Although,
yeah.
I there are some people who I admire so much I can't interview them correctly.
Right.
You probably know this.
Yeah,
right?
So it happens all the time
basically
in sports.
All your questions are either, how cool are you?
Yeah.
Or even worse, let me show you by asking this question that I'm your biggest fan.
Right, right. It's very Chris Farley. Remember when you were in the Beatles?
Yeah.
Yes,
exactly.
From SNL.
I noticed that.
Yeah.
Because I'm your biggest fan.
Yes, it happens to all of us.
Yeah.
We do
yeah.
it. It's
it really
embarrassing.
Does.
Yeah. You wrote a book called The Book of Vice, Very Naughty Things and How to Do Them, which was inspired by the time you spent attempting to ghostwrite the biography of a 1970s pornography director who actually
yes.
wasn't. She was just a front for her husband or boyfriend who was the real director. So in your writing of The Book of Vice, what was the craziest thing that you learned or discussed with someone?
My answer has changed because of certain circumstances, but now the most interesting thing I did during researching that book was I had dinner with a young woman named Stormy Daniels.
Okay.
Yes.
That has
and
changed
in
with
the book,
time.
So I recommend people pick that up. I think it's still in print. And I got to tell you, when it became apparent, when it became public knowledge that Stormy Daniels had had a thing with Donald Trump and that she wanted to talk about it, I said, this is going to be great. Because Stormy Daniels, who I had dinner with more than 10 years ago, was the most charming, funny, smart storyteller I had ever met. She absolutely had the table in stitches. She had amazing stories. She was incredibly straightforward. She was utterly shameless in the best way, i.e. she didn't apologize for what she had chosen to do with her life and career. And she, in fact, was quite proud of it. And I knew that if and when Stormy came forward to start talking about what had happened, she would be that person. And it's been awesome to watch. I hope she remembers me as fondly as I remember her.
That's crazy. That's, yeah. Stormy didn't. I used to have to, when I worked at the restaurant where I met Michael Jackson, one of the regulars was Ron Jeremy. So that was was my regular interaction with a very well-known porn star.
Do you know, I missed a chance to have drinks with him once. I had spent the day in a porn set.
I don't know if I'd say you're missing it, Bob.
Yeah, well, and it was a long day, and it went late into the night, and a woman who was working there said, "Hey, I'm about to go have drinks with my boyfriend, Ron Jeremy. You want to come?"
Oh, boy.
And I was like, no. But to this day, I regret it, because I could be telling you about having the time I had drinks with Ron Jeremy. But
right, and you did say in another interview that the best way to decide whether to take a job or do anything is whether there'll be good anecdotes for later, and that would have been a good one.
Yep.
That would have been a
good
one.
As you say, and I regret not having one to this day. But I met Stormy Daniels, so that makes up for it.
There you go. You get that one. And I'm sure there's plenty more in the Book of Vice for people beyond the Stormy Daniels to learn about people's proclivities and otherwise. You do a Game of Thrones podcast. Are you going to do a different podcast when it ends? There's going to be a Game of Thrones prequel. My sister says you have to do a podcast for that as well.
First of all, thank you for bringing it up, because of all the things I do, I probably enjoy doing that the most. Because A, I get to let my inner nerd flag totally fly again. secondly, I just adore the two women I do it with, Gretchen and Trisha, who are just awesome. They're the nerdettes. They have their own podcast, which I recommend to everybody. And it's really fun. And it's just so much fun to sit around with friends and talk about this TV show. I was about to say that all of us like. It's actually, Gretchen actually doesn't like it that much, which I think
I have never seen an episode. So the fact that that's your favorite thing you do makes me really feel like, even more than I already do, that I'm missing out on this great milestone of our time.
Well, you know, it's totally, this is my experience. This was certainly true in the first seasons, and then it became a huge phenomenon. I don't know if it's true anymore. You have to, like, buy into the whole setting, which is
right.
A fantasy world, made up names, a completely fictional map, guys with swords, dragons, magic working in the world. Did you like Lord of the Rings? Did you like those movies?
I didn't see those either.
Oh, my God.
Or well, Harry Potter.
Not,
or
yeah, all right. Wait a minute. You have seen Harry Potter, right?
No.
Oh, my God. What did you do as a kid? What kind of cool thing? You were running track and being socially
yes.
adept and going to
yes.
parties. That's your
yeah.
problem.
I know. I've got a lot to catch up on.
I know.
I've wasted my life interacting with other people.
Yeah, you see, and if only you had been a completely asocial, depressed nerd, you could have ended up with a podcast talking about Game of Thrones.
Like, instead, I'm just talking to you.
I know. And I could go on about this. I won't. First of all, Gretchen and Trisha and I have never managed to come up with something else that engages all three of us enough to talk about. So we'll absolutely do the last season of Game of Thrones when it happens next year. And then we'll see. The prequels might be fun.
I hope
we come up with something, because I just absolutely love those women and love talking to them and joking around with them and being teased by them and teasing them back. In terms of Game of Thrones, it's weird. Remember I said that, you know, I grew up, just staring at TVs and reading these books and so on and so forth. And it turns out so did a lot of other people.
Right.
And a lot of those people are now in their 40s or 50s. And those people are making these comic book movies, and they're making Game of Thrones, and they're making the Harry Potter movies and the Lord of the Rings movies and all these other great works of fantasy and science fiction. And what they're doing, and this is kind of fun, is they're recreating the stuff of their youth, the high fantasy or science fiction of their youth, but they're making it better. Like, the best example is Battlestar Galactica. Did you watch that?
No.
Again, you're out talking to people and being healthy. So Battlestar Galactica was this big TV show of the 80s. It was a post-Star Wars TV show. And I remember being so excited. It was actually the late 70s. I was so excited for this cool new science fiction TV show. It was like my dreams come true. And I remember sitting there watching it. And I said, everybody, nobody bother me. I got to go upstairs and watch my TV show. So I sat in my armchair and I was watching it. and it came on, and there it was, and it was epic, and it was amazing, and it was terrible. It was really bad. And Lorne Michaels was the lead, man. It was not good.
Oh no.
And there was another, guy, whose name escapes me right now. He ended up working on Star Trek. His first name is Ron. I can't remember his last name. Who also watched it when he was a kid and also noticed that it was terrible. And he decided he was going to make it better. So he did. So they rebooted it. And this time, instead of silly science fiction, it was like gritty military drama in which people go through trauma and react as people do who go through trauma, sometimes not wisely. Instead of this fantasy setting of a spaceship, they had a spaceship, but they researched it by spending time on aircraft carriers. Hmm. So there was this bizarre realism to it. And that's happening. So people of my generation are gifting the rest of you, at least people who care, with redoing the stuff of our youth. Game of Thrones is a great example. We grew up on Lord of the Rings. We read it. But Lord of the Rings had some flaws. For example, none of the people ever seem to be interested in sex, which is weird because most people are.
Right.
And so at Game of Thrones, well, what happens if you actually introduce sex and sexual attraction into that world? What happens? And it turns out not many good things.
Right.
And there are lots of other aspects I could go on about. You could tell.
Well, I need to watch it in part just because all of the people that I respect love it and are doing good content around it, and I can't enjoy that content until I watch it. So either I will alienate my friends, suffer an injury, and no longer be able to be active, or maybe I'll get a sabbatical and get some extra time. But either way, I'm going to make it happen.
Yeah.
I'm going to figure it out.
This is true of the books as well. If you can make it through, if you watch the first episode, which throws you into this world, and not only into the rules of the world, but it's this mythical place, and these are the kind of characters, and they have swords instead of guns, et cetera, and they ride horses. And if you can, and then you find out what kind of people they are, which in some cases is not very nice people. If you get through that and you say to yourself, holy, that was amazing, I want to see what happens next, you'll be hooked for the rest of your life.
Right.
If you get through that and you say to yourself, what terrible people in silly costumes, I have no interest in this, well then, it's okay. Go back to being social and talking to real people.
There you go. Well, before I let you go, you have to do the one thing that everybody does but nobody expects.
Didn't expect the kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
That's right, the Spanish Inquisition. The same questions that everybody answers but nobody expects. Number one, what's the natural talent you wish you were gifted with?
The natural talent I wish I was gifted with, other than the ones that we have suggested, I wish I could play a musical instrument. I'm musically completely untalented. I've never been able to master it, and I think people who can play music, even amateurs, are like wizards, and I wish I had that palette.
Number two, what's your desert island album? You can only have one.
Oh, my gosh, my desert island album. Oh, that's tricky. I'm thinking about the music that's meant most to me, and it's probably an Elvis Costello record, and it would probably be my favorite Elvis Costello record, which is an interesting choice for Elvis Costello fans, but it would be Blood and Chocolate.
Okay. I don't have that. I don't have Elvis Costello on my Spanish Inquisition yet, so that's a good one. Number three, if you could switch lives with anyone for a day, who would it be?
For a day?
Mm-hmm.
For just one day?
Just
and I get
one
to go
day.
Back and be myself after the day?
Yep.
I would like to be Kim Kardashian.
Oh, interesting.
Because
very interesting.
I think it's really interesting to be Kim Kardashian. I think that she has a life that like no one else on earth, and I just can't imagine what it would be like to be Kim Kardashian, to have walking out your door be international news because of what you were wearing, and I would just like to see what that's like. I would like to be Kim Kardashian on a day when Kanye is out of town.
Yeah, that's a great, great choice. He's been voted off the island,
yeah.
So hopefully that would be a day. Number four, what's the most scared you've ever been?
Oh, God. What is the most scared I've ever been? Quite literally, probably, let's see, I was about to say right before I proposed to my first wife, and I turned out to be right about that. Probably physically, I got hit by a car while I was riding my bike.
Mm.
And it wasn't after I was hit by a car. I was just in pain because I knew I was alive, but it was during that moment, that sort of what they call an event horizon, when Are you still there? I'm sorry. I just heard a noise on my phone.
Yes. Yep.
Okay. There's that moment that other people who've been through this, accidents and stuff like this, talk about, where you know it's going to happen. There is nothing you can do to stop it. But you're aware that you just crossed from the world of, in this case, somebody who's never been hit by a car to someone who was hit by a car, or you're about to be hit by a car. There's nothing you can do. You are about to become that person. And the only thing I can compare that feeling of terror to is the moment in Toy Story where Woody says, I'm a lost toy. Because you know the way that Tom Hanks says that line, that being a lost toy is the worst thing that they know about.
Right.
That's like a horrible thing. And it had just happened to him. And that's what it felt like. I was like, I'm about to be somebody who was hit by a car.
Yeah.
And this is going to change my life one way or another. It kind of did, actually.
Wow.
But fortunately, the physical injury was not that bad. So I came out of it okay.
Yeah. Number five, what's the most embarrassed you've ever been?
Oh, geez, how much time do we have? We've taken up a whole hour. Since this is ESPN and ostensibly about athletics, out of all the things I could possibly mention, and I have lists and lists of embarrassing moments, I will choose an athletic one. In the eighth grade, we have one of those male gym teachers who was very, very aggressive about all his kids being tough. And his particular thing was wrestling. He wanted all the kids to be wrestlers. So you couldn't get out of it, even if you were an unathletic blob like me in the eighth grade. So we did the wrestling unit, and he always had the wrestling unit ended with a tournament in front of the entire school. We're going to have a wrestling tournament, the annual wrestling tournament. And it just so happened that in the entire eighth grade, there were two boys in the 135 weight class, me and Bruce Bennett. And Bruce Bennett was 135 pounds of adolescent muscle, and I was not. And further, because there were only two of us, we were going right to the finals.
Oh, no.
If there had been four of us, I would have had a preliminary round, been easily eliminated, no one would have known, and I would have watched the match from the stand. But instead, I had to wrestle Bruce Bennett, and this was literally the first competitive wrestling match I had ever done because there was no preliminary round. I had to wrestle Bruce Bennett. He pinned me in 8 seconds.
Oh, no.
Two of which were him just crossing the mat, you know? So boom, down. And that's and I had to lie there with Bruce Bennett on top of me, listening to the hysterical laughter of the entire junior high population, including, I'm sure, many of the teachers.
Oh.
So that's even as I talk about it now, I start to cringe. And it's funny, many years later, I was practicing a martial art called Aikido, and I remember, you know, asking people to pretend they were coming at me in a wrestling grab and practicing throwing them to the ground just to try to expunge the memory. It didn't work,
but it
was fun.
At Cornell Track, we occasionally had to put a teammate on our back and do stadium stairs. And so you're supposed to find someone that weighed roughly the same as you. And occasionally it would be a guy for me. So that's also
interesting.
I'm very tall, but it still doesn't feel good. So I'm
just
going
to say, if you were able to carry, if you were able to double your body weight by carrying some guy and run stadiums, I find that extremely impressive, whoever the hell it was.
Oh, yeah. So maybe less embarrassing than impressive. I'll go with that. We'll take it.
Okay.
Number six, what would you consider your biggest failure?
Oh, God. Putting aside my marriage, my first marriage, my second one's going great. So I think I'm
excellent.
I don't know. I think my biggest failure, that's tough. It's weird, you know, because as we've discussed earlier, I'm somebody who isn't very impressed with myself. But you asked me about being you know what my biggest failure is I think I could have been, if things had gone different, a really great playwright.
Hmm.
I was getting started, and I was getting breaks that you need to get, and I was getting attention that you need to get. But one of the things about being an aspiring artist is you work and you work and you work, and you think if you just get through that door, you're set, right? I just got to get through the door. I just got to get through the door, and then I'll be set. Everything will be easy. And what you find out, and this is, I'm, of course, absolutely true of athletics as well, I should say. And if you just get that break, just get picked for the team, whatever it may be. Once you get through the door, it's not easy. It's another door. And right. after that is another door. You have to keep working, and you have to keep practicing, and you have to keep at it. And I'm not going to say I just quit and walked away. But when another opportunity came to do this radio show, I took it in part because I knew that it would be a little easier. And I've had an amazing career. It turned out okay. I got no complaints. It has brought me rewards of all kinds. And all the things that we've discussed this whole hour about reaching people and comforting them and being of value to them, these are all great things. But sometimes I think, this may be more of a serious answer than you wanted, but sometimes I think about the plays and maybe movies and stuff I could have written. And I think of somebody like Michael Schur, who for whatever reason, kept at it and has done great, great things. And who knows? Maybe I could have created those things, and now we'll never know.
I think most of us who are creators think that way about the other things we wanted to do initially and then where we ended up. It doesn't mean we aren't grateful, but you still are curious. So doesn't surprise me at all.
You know, there are people, I'm sure, who think about the symphonies they were supposed to write or the, and we all ended up doing what we needed to do to make a living and raise families. And I think we should be pleased with ourselves.
Agreed.
I'll remind myself of that.
Agreed. In fact, you yourself are the person who said, the people you love are the kind people, the ones who treat you with delight when they see you. These days, instead of struggling to be the most amazing leave my name in the sands of time person, I'm trying to be that guy. So if you're doing that, then it doesn't matter as much if you're writing the great American novel. Some would say it's a bigger achievement.
That's the hope. That's something that came to me relatively late in life, mainly because I was being subjected to a lot of cruelty. And I decided that the best response to that was not to give in and instead try to treat at least other people in my life who are not better than that. And I've come around to believe that that's the legacy. You know, I do, like a lot of people getting older, I read obituaries. And one of the things I love to see in obituaries is people saying he was wonderful or she was great. She was kind. She was always there. She always had a smile on her face. She was somebody who brightened the room.
Right.
And I would much rather leave that obituary behind than, you know, let's take an obvious example, Harvey Weinstein's obituary, which will list all his Oscars and list all his achievements and all the amazing things he did and the fame and the money and the houses. And then it will say pretty terrible things about him as a person.
Right.
That's an extreme example. But, you know, that's something I think about a lot these days.
I think it's a good approach for sure. Home stretch here. Number 7, what habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
Probably that dissatisfaction that we were talking about.
Right.
That absolute refusal to think that what I've done is good enough and try to be a little bit better. Certainly, you know, a lot of people, I mean, to this day, you know, I do, you know, I've been doing White Weight Thunder for 20 years, but every day on Thursday, which is show day, I still am doubtful that what we're going to do is going to work. And I think that doubt, you know, makes me just try a little bit harder. You know, I don't want to be a coaster, and I think that I'll hopefully won't allow myself to at least overly do that.
Number 8, have you ever been in a fist fight?
I have never been in a fist fight. Once I practiced the Aikido, I was kind of hoping I could try one, but it's never happened. I'm just going to say no. I've never been in a fist fight, and to try
it's
to
impressive.
Come up with a near example would be a disservice to those people who are actually in a fist fight.
Number 9, what's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
Other than my height? I would absolutely, this is funny. This is turning into more of a therapy session than a podcast. I would love to improve my discipline and focus. Everybody who knows me knows that I am so easily distracted. So my mind is racing in 100 different directions. It's hard to get myself to focus. It's hard for other people to get me to focus. And I think that would be both important, both in terms of my work, getting stuff done, projects done, you know, go back to that writing career I might have had. And also in terms of the relationships I have in my life, because sometimes I'm too distracted by whatever to focus on the person I'm with.
Right.
And fortunately, I'm now married to a wonderful woman who loves me anyway, which I am very, very grateful for. But I think I could do a lot better both in dealing with her and in everybody else I come across by just remembering to be there in the moment and be focused and not thinking about, you know, what's going to happen next or an email I got or whatever it may be.
And finally, number 10, this goes back potentially to the OBIT stuff. What three words would you most hope people would use to describe you?
What three words? You want like a sentence or like three adjectives?
No, three separate words.
Three
That's
separate
what you would
words.
Hope they would say.
I will say, maybe how about this? Kind, most importantly, entertaining, secondly, and harmless.
Oh, that's an interesting one. Harmless.
Yeah.
I like that. And the bonus, who would you recommend I have on the podcast to have a conversation with?
Who would I recommend? Gosh, I'm trying to think. Let me give you somebody who I've recently gotten to know and who I admire tremendously, and that's Eve Ewing. She is an academic, a poet, a writer in Chicago. She has done tremendous stuff, both in terms of her artistic output and in her civic involvement with the issues of Chicago that are making news, but are not being solved by the people who are trying to talk about it. She is a fierce and independent and creative person. And most recently, she was announced as the author of the Marvel comic book about the young girl from Chicago who becomes the next
That's
Iron
how
Man.
I've heard of her.
Of character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ironheart,
awesome.
Right?
Yeah. She's pretty
cool.
Amazing. Get her. Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks so much. This was so fantastic to talk to you. My sister and my mom have gone to see Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and I have not gone with them, so I'm going to have to next time they make a trip.
If you do, by all means, come up and say hello. I really enjoyed this. I was impressed by your questions and the amount of research you did. I don't work that hard when I'm interviewing people, so you impressed me.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. And I will, I'll send Michael an email and just tell him that you would love to chat with him and see if I can
give him your contact info.
And
feel free to connect him with me via, I think you producers have my email and all that. So absolutely, by all means.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Peter.
Right. Thank you. And I really enjoyed it.
Oh, and another thing.
This week's That's What She Read is actually a listen, and I mentioned it during my conversation with Peter. It's a podcast called The Hilarious World of Depression, and the first episode from December of 2016 is with Peter Sagal. If you Google The Hilarious World of Depression and Peter's name, it will come up, and it's just a fascinating interview, and it dives into everything from some of the stuff we covered about his divorce and how that brought on these feelings of depression that he'd sort of shielded earlier in his life, and also that neuroscientist that we mentioned in our conversation, Daniel Levitin, talking about how you can help and hurt a depressed person's brain in times of crisis, what some of the better ways to handle it are, and an interesting thought about music and the idea that if you're sad and you listen to sad music, most people would think it makes you sadder. But so often when you're sad or depressed, you feel misunderstood. And so connecting with somebody who seems to be feeling those same emotions in song can actually bring you out of it. And I've always found that interesting because I often, when I'm sad, listen to very sad music and it makes me feel better and I'm not sure why. So to have a neuroscientist sort of explain what's going on in my brain during those times was very cool. Anyway, it's a really cool conversation, and especially for anyone who's interested in mental health or has mental health issues of their own, The Hilarious World of Depression, Episode 1 with Peter Sagal. Look it up. Listen to it. And thanks, as always, for lasting about an hour with me.
That's what she said.